that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day. And through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes? My heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And good morning and welcome to this October 6, 2010 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and at iTunes News Talk Radio. And we're always available via podcasts. We're your hosts, Barbara DeMarco Barrett
and Marie Stone. And as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world.
And it's our pleasure today to be here again together, 2 weeks in a row, Marie.
Very fun. Very fun.
And to welcome best-selling author Amy Bloom this morning. And coming up in our second half hour, Hillary Davidson will be here.
Author of two novels, three collections of short stories, and a nominee for both the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her stories have appeared in Best American Short Stories, Prize Stories, the O. Henry Awards, and numerous anthologies here and abroad. She has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic Monthly, among many other publications, and has won a National Magazine Award. Her most recent novel, Away, was an epic story about a Russian immigrant. Her new collection of short stories, Where the God of Love Hangs Out, published by Random House in January of 2010. She lives in Connecticut and taught at Yale University for the last decade, and she will now be at Wellesleyan University's Writer in Residence. Amy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So maybe we can start by allowing you to talk about the collection and how the stories came together for you.
Well, I had started writing the stories a long time ago in my first collection, Come to Me. It's the first appearance of the Lionel and Julia story, Sleepwalking. But even in that collection, I had linked a bunch of the short stories. It's interesting to me. I think that linking short stories is something that writers do all the time, and it's just that periodically people notice. Alice Adams was a great fan of it. Cheever was a great fan of it. It's not as if anybody wakes up and goes, I know, I'll do what no one has ever thought of. I'll link my stories. It's just that sometimes people notice and sometimes they don't. In this particular collection, I have two quartets of stories, one about the Sampson family, which begins with Lionel and Julia, and another one about four friends, William and Claire, but the stories are largely told from William and Claire's points of view.
Hmm. So many of the stories, you mentioned William and Claire and Julia and Lionel, so many of them are focused on sex and death. Actually, maybe most of them are focused on death, and Claire and William and Julia and Lionel seem to be so much about sex and death, and I found these stories so moving and wondered if you would embellish a bit on those interconnected stories in particular.
Well, I suppose there are a couple of things. One is that aside from war, which is certainly a way of talking about death, or politics, if you're interested in another kind of theme, I'm not sure what else one really writes about except love and death. The sex, to me, seems to be a form of of the love that's going on between people. But I would say in every story there's a primary love relationship, whether or not it's sexual or romantic. It's still about some passionate connection between one person and another person. And it's true, those are the things that are interesting to me. I mean, you know, one is hardly going to write a long collection of stories about, you know, clipping coupons or the enormous tragedy of your child not getting into the college of their choice. I mean, those things are just, you know, they're worthy of a passing sentence, but they're certainly not worthy of the time and effort that you ask the reader to put into it as well as the writer. So I think for me, love is probably always my subject, you know, the way society was for Trollope. I don't know that you always get to choose your subject. I think it tends to find you.
You know, playing off of your conversation about the interlinking of short stories, these two quartets do sort of feel like they're straddling that elegant line between short story and trying to, you know, push into the realm of novella. You know, I think all of these characters are certainly worthy of novels. Can you talk about wanting to revisit characters, their stories and lives over the course of three or more short stories, but resisting committing them to novel length works?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I mean, it never feels to me like a resistance or a pushing into. It always feels to me pretty much the way you would look at any kind of composition. I mean, even in the visual arts, you would go, oh, this needs this here. But in the same way with a painting, you say, oh, I think this really needs two leaves here or two slashes of green here. But it doesn't necessarily mean that what you really think is, I need a forest, you know. And so for me, as I stayed with these characters and I would begin working on a story, and then I would say to myself, oh, that's William and Claire. Or, oh, that's Julia 10 years later. And then I would proceed with the next story. And then at a point, I thought to myself, oh, look, this is a quartet. And it seemed to me that part of what you hope is that you are able to see what it is and see if that works the way you've left it. If I felt that something was missing, I certainly wouldn't have been reluctant to make it into a novel or a novella, although I would say that probably the space between four linked short stories and a novella is a pretty small space that you could sort of blow into or not. But I think for me, it was, you know, these four pearls on this chain, and that seemed just right.
You know, back to Claire and William, I loved these stories so much, and I could have read about them and whatever was going on with them for much longer. Do you have trouble ever in the same way ending? Do you say, you know, I'm just going to stay with them, or I can't make that one die, or I have to go on with this? Or do you just know if you're committed to a story that it has to end in some way and pretty quickly?
Well, part of what's important about a short story is very much the shape, you know, is the beginning and the end, and a lot of attention to the middle. But you know, I don't feel even now that I know that there is no more to say about Lionel and Patsine and Buster and Jewel and their children. I know that I'm done for now. But, you know, I hope I'll be writing for the next 20 years. And so it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Corinne shows up as a young woman starting law school. Mm-hmm. You know, and if that happens, then, you know, eventually instead of having a quartet, maybe I'll have 8 or 9. And then maybe that will be its own little book of this family's life.
Does that tend to happen fairly often where characters just tend to haunt you for, you know, a decade or two? I know some of these characters you've been with for you know, over the course of other books as well. Are there particular characters that just tend to stay with you and other sorts of characters that you're able to put to bed pretty easily in your mind?
Yeah, but even the ones that stay with me, it doesn't really feel so much like haunting as it is as if I am at the airport going to pick up, you know, Uncle Harry, and suddenly there is Cousin Izzy. And I'm like, oh, I see. And so, you know, you pick up whoever it is who comes to the airport. Mm-hmm. But it's more like that. So I don't usually have a sense of, oh, I can't let go of this person, or I have definitely let go of this person. That's a little more true with my novels, but even with my last novel, Away, I have a character who has emerged in the new novel that I'm working on.
Hmm. Amy, this would be a great time to have you read from Where the God of Love Hangs Out, would you?
Sure. I'll read a couple of pages from a William and Claire story, which is the middle of the quartet, and it's called I Love to See You Coming, I Hate to See You Go.
Okay.
William is married to Isabel, who is not at home for the day, and he and Claire have been having an on-and-off affair for a number of years. Claire has driven up to visit him. Isabel has called to say, my mother's not well, I have to stay away for the evening. Claire, would you please keep an eye on him? And Claire says that she will. William snorts and wakes up, his hair wild and waving like silver palm fronds. He looks like he might have had a bad dream, and Claire smiles to comfort him. He looks at her as if he's never seen her, or never seen her like this, which isn't so. He has seen her 100 times just like this, seated across from him, deep in thought, flinging her legs over the arm of the chair to get comfortable. Oh, here you are, he says. Do you want some dinner? How can you, William says. What kind of dinner did you have in mind? Aren't you the most pathetic thing? And Claire walks over to smooth his dream-blown hair. They stay like this so long, her hands on his head, his head against her chest, that neither one of them can think of what the next natural thing to do is. We could go to bed, William says. Claire goes into the kitchen and gathers up everything that wasn't eaten at lunch in every promising plastic container, including a couple of olives and a lot of pineapple cottage juice, and she lays it all on the coffee table in front of William with a couple of forks and 2 napkins. You do go all out, he says. I don't know how Isabel caters to you the way she does. If Charles were as much of a baby as you, I'd get a nurse and check into a hotel. I'm sure you would, he says. He doesn't say again that they could go to bed. She heard him the first time. This might not be the farewell dinner, and you could hardly call it dinner. It's not even a snack. It's what a desperately hungry person with no taste buds might grab while running through a burning house. But it has that feeling. She's brought him sensible food and no wine, and an intelligent, disinterested observer would have to say, it doesn't look good right now for the fat man. Okay, Claire says, let's go to bed. Husbands and wives can skip sex without fuss, without it even being a cause for fuss, but Claire can't imagine how you say to the person whom you have driven to see for the express purpose of having sex, let's just read the newspaper. William lies under the sheets and the comforter, leaving his foot uncovered and resting, like the royal turnip, on a round velvet pillow taken from Isabel's side of the bed. Is your gout better? Claire asks. It is better. I hate for you to have to see it, he says. Claire shrugs, and William doesn't know if that means that seeing his foot grotesquely swollen and purple cannot diminish her ardor, or that her ardor, such as it is, could hardly be diminished. You looked very cute in my socks, I have to tell you, and William puts a hand on Claire's stomach. I don't know, Claire says. I think maybe we have to stop this. I think William laughs before he sees her face. This is exactly what he has hoped not to hear. And he thought that if she was naked beside him, bare of his socks and her reading glasses, that they would get through the night without having this conversation. Claire turns on her side to look at him. You don't think I might have a guilty conscience? You might have a guilty conscience, he says. Sometimes people confuse that with a fear of getting caught. Claire does not say that she would cut William's throat and toss his body in the dump before she would let her husband find them, and that there is clearly something wrong with William that he would even mention this possibility. I don't want to get a guilty conscience, she says. Let's just say that. There is nothing to be gained by arguing, William thinks. What they have is nothing to their marriages. Claire to Isabel, he to Charles, just 2 cups of water to the ocean. There's no reason to say, remember the time you wore my shirt around the motel room like a trench coat and belted it with my tie to go get ice? Remember when you sat on top of me in that park and you pulled off your T-shirt and the summer light fell through the leaves onto your white shoulders and you bent down close to me, your hair brushing my face? I have never known another woman who can bear, let alone sing, all of the Pirates of Penzance, and who else will ever love me in this deep, narrow, greedy way? We'll do whatever you want, William says, and Claire laughs. I don't think so. I think what I want in this regard is not possible. Probably not, he says. Oh, Claire thinks, put up a fuss. Throw something, rise up, tell me that whatever this costs, however pointless this is, the pleasure of it is so great, your need for me is so tremendous that however this will end, and we are too old not to know that it'll end either this way with common sense and muted loss, and a sad cup of coffee, or with something worse in a parking lot somewhere, and not likely to cover either one of us with glory, it is somehow worth it. And William closes his eyes. I would like it, Claire thinks, if seeing you would always make me happy. I would like to have lost nothing along the way. What do you think? She says. I don't know, William says. Farewell, Happy Fields. You're not helping. I'm not trying to help. Oh, Claire says. It's late, William says. I know, and Claire rolls towards him. Her head is on his chest, her chin above his heart. His hand is deep in her hair. They sleep like this, a tiny tribe, a sliver of marriage, and in their dreams, Claire is still married to Charles, and they are at Coney Island before it burned down, riding double on number 7 in the steeplechase, and they are winning, and they keep riding, and the stars are as thick as snow. And in his dream, William is still married to Isabel, and she brings their daughter home from the hospital. And when William sets her down in the crib, which is much larger and prettier than the one they really had when they lived on Elm Street, he sees that their baby has small sky-blue wings and little clawed feet. And William kisses the baby's pearly forehead, and he says to his wife in the dream and to Claire lying beside him, "It's not the end of the world, darling." There.
That was beautiful. That was Amy Bloom reading from Where the God of Love Hangs Out. You're listening to 88.9 FM in Irvine, Writers on Writing. One of the things I always admire is your ability to shift between multiple points of view within a story, within one paragraph to the next. And that also, you know, we're kind of told as writers, as new writers, we're warned against that. But here it always seems to work. Are there tricks or rules you follow to make that seem so seamless, or is it just by ear that it works out as beautifully as it does?
Well, I think you have to believe in the multiple points of view. I mean, the reason that people say don't do this is not because it's morally wrong. They mean because you don't have the skill to do it. No, it's like most workshop rules, which is perfectly understandable. But the reality is you have to be able to inhabit more than one soul. And if you can't, then you won't be able to succeed in switching points of view because only one of them will seem real to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's the reason that when Updike changes points of view from his male characters, whom he believes and loves and inhabits, to his female characters, whom I think he enjoys and admires at a great psychic distance, there's a tremendous loss.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because he's a bad writer. He's a wonderful writer. But in fact, the point of view of his female characters has no meaning to him except from the point of view of the male characters. In other words, he can see the guys looking at the women, wondering why they do what they do, but he cannot be the woman under the guy's gaze.
You know, speaking of that and inhabiting character and so fully inhabiting character, I was wondering, so you were a psychotherapist in the past, and I'm
mm-hmm.
wondering how much that infuses and kind of, you know, informs some of your characters.
Well, I don't have much of a sense of that. I suspect I became a psychotherapist because I find people interesting, which is some of the same reasons that I like to write, because I find people interesting and I like to create their stories. But it is true that empathy is not sufficient to be a good writer, but it's certainly necessary. You cannot write characters whom you cannot feel, and you can't write them from a position of judgment going, oh, look at the crazy, stupid thing she's doing. Boy, I wouldn't do something like that. It's like really good acting. You cannot have you can't have the actor poking you in the ribs and going, it's not really me. I wouldn't do something like that. You know, you have to be willing to embrace all your terrible, awful parts and let people see that in your good sentences.
I'm curious, Amy, about moments that you may have felt stuck or lost yourself in a piece and quite didn't know quite how to get through it. Has that happened to you?
Sure.
With this collection even, and what do you do when that happens? I mean, how do you tell the difference between, say, being bored with a piece and it not working, or when it's just time to abandon, when it's time to go on? I mean, what do you do with all that?
Well, frankly, if I'm bored with a piece, there's a really good possibility that it should not ever see the light of day. You know, the world does not need more fiction. You know, so if I'm bored, it's possibly because it's just not very good and it's not shaped the way it needs to be shaped, and maybe that will occur to me later, but maybe what I need to do is stop. The last story in this collection, Where the God of Love Hangs Out, was the last story that I wrote, and originally the story was entirely from Ray's point of view, and Macy was sort of barely a passing character. But I had to leave it alone for quite some time. You know, I would go back to it, but I kept saying, this isn't right, this isn't right, this isn't the story I'm trying to tell. What is the story I'm trying to tell? And then it was a story between Ray and his wife, Ellie, and it wasn't until I could really see and hear Macy and her perspective on their family and her own issues and secrets that suddenly I realized it was actually about the love between Ray and Macy.
You know, that raises one question that I had about character drawing character. I'd read somewhere that you kind of have a musical score for characters in the back of your mind, you know, what songs they're thinking of. I think Claire had a secret song that she kept in her mind for William. Is there other invisible work that you do for these characters, extra writing or character sketches or, you know, kind of mental scrapbooks that you keep for these characters to enrich them and build them up?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what makes its way into the published story is the greatest hits. You know, not all the slogging and mess. You know, it's like, you know, what you want to show is the beautiful garment. You know, you don't want to be sitting there with a lot of people with blood-stained fingertips.
What form does that take typically? Is it just pages?
Sometimes it's notes, sometimes it's writing out a scene from more than one point of view. Usually for me, it's a lot of sitting around trying to hear the voice of the different characters and then writing it down when I hear it.
We are sadly at the end of our time with you, and this half hour has flown by as usual. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening who may be working on short fiction.
Well, I guess my advice, you know, is sort of very much along the Winston Churchill line, which is, you know, never give up, never give up, never give up. And even in the case of crisis, never give up, except possibly in the case of moral disaster. You know? And I think that that's good advice. I mean, this is a hard, lonely business. And, you know, the great satisfaction is in the story that you wish to tell and the best sentence you can come up with. And you have to be prepared to, you know, keep stumbling over that rock over and over and over again until you put it in the right place. But there's no, you know, there's no shame in that. You are supposed to fail because it's really hard.
That's always good to hear. It's always true. Amy, this was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time with us.
Thanks so much for having me. Talk to you next time.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
You can find out more on Amy Bloom at amybloom.com. The book is Where the God of Love Hangs Out. It's published by Random House. Really is a wonderful read. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with us. Hillary Davidson will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We're under Talk News as opposed to Public Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. We're your hosts, Marie Stone.
And Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And we are joined now by Hillary Davidson. Hillary's short fiction has been featured in anthologies, including A Prisoner of Memory and 24 of the Year's Finest Crime and Mystery Stories, and Blood, Guts, and Whiskey. They're also in dark places, such as Thuglit, Beat to a Pulp, Crime Spree, A Twist of Noir, and Crime Factory. Her story, Insatiable, originally published by Beat to a Pulp, won a 2010 Spine Tingler Award for Best Short Story. Before Hillary turned to a life of crime, she was a travel writer and got her start in journalism in 1995 when she interned at Harper's Magazine in New York. She returned to her hometown, Toronto, and joined the staff at Canadian Living Magazine for 2 years before going freelance. Since then, she's written 18 nonfiction books, and 17 of them travel guidebooks, and hundreds of articles for magazines such as Discover, Martha Stewart Weddings, and American Archaeology. She was born and raised in Toronto, but has lived in New York since October 2001. And she's here today to talk about her debut novel, The Damage Done, published by Forge in September. Hi, Hillary.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're so welcome. Let's begin by hearing about The Damage Done and how the book came about.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I would say that in a way it's been bubbling at the back of my brain for years, because when I went freelance, I actually thought that I would have time to write fiction as well as writing nonfiction, and that somehow, if I were writing full-time, it would actually make it easier. And instead, it made it harder. And I came up with the idea for the book several years ago and then didn't write it until about 2 years ago. So it was a long time percolating.
Now, had you been reading mysteries and that's why it took the form of a mystery, or how'd that happen?
I'd say that I have been a mystery reader pretty much all of my life, and I blame my grandmother for that. She was a wonderful influence in terms of buying me a lot of books, and she introduced me to a lot of noir movies and that as well, that she loved kind of classic films from the 40s and 50s. But she started me at a very early age on Nancy Drew books, which I often think of as the gateway drug into mystery. And, you know, it went from there into Agatha Christie and then Robert B. Parker books and then Walter Mosley books, and basically, you know, building over the course of years as I, you know, got older and discovered more writers. So I feel like I've been reading mysteries pretty much my whole life. And even books that aren't considered mysteries, I tend to look at them as sort of psychological thrillers. I remember when I was 12 talking to a teacher at school about William Golding's Lord of the Flies, and I was talking about it as a mystery, and my teacher was saying, no, that's wrong, that's literature. And there's this divide between mysteries and literature. But so I feel like I've really loved that genre my entire life.
Hmm. I wanted to talk about your character in The Damage Done, Lily Moore, who is a travel writer, and she's in Spain when her sister Claudia is discovered dead in her apartment, and the people who find her feel that it's a suicide, and Lily has to return to New York to deal with this. How did that conflict come about?
I guess when I started envisioning Lily, she was almost a character who came along with me while I traveled. A lot of the time when I've worked on stories as a travel writer, I've been traveling alone. Very early on, I did some group trips, but I discovered it's really much easier to sort of work getting what I needed just traveling on my own in different places. And so I kind of, I think, consider her in a way my imaginary friend who's, you know, traveled with me here and there. And when I started writing about her, I was thinking of her as someone who was running away from something. I'm a bit of a slacker when it comes to travel writing, because the two places I've written the most about are my hometown, Toronto, and my adopted hometown, New York. And I have gone on some exotic trips, like going to Easter Island and going to Peru and going to Turkey. But really, you know, that's something that's maybe come up a couple of times a year or three times a year, whereas Lily travels all the time. And I was thinking, well, what sort of background would really make someone want to get into that? And there were so many different directions that I guess you could go in, but I felt like Lily was running from a very troubled family past, and I had a sense of her as having a sister very close in age, and in a way having a close relationship. Their father died when Lily was 13, and her sister was about 11 and a half, and that really was the catalyst for a lot of bad things in their lives. Their mother, who was a bit unstable already, was also an alcoholic and sort of uprooted them and moved them from place to place. And so there's this kind of bond between Lily and Claudia where they're sort of the only two people who understand what's happened and can talk about these things and have this bond. But there's also this just sort of a difficulty that they have being in the same room together, because Claudia has been a drug addict for years and Lily very much wants to fix her sister and, of course, you know, has never succeeded at doing that. And because she can't do that, she really wants to run away from the situation. But Lily, being a good girl, needs a reason to run away. And so that reason actually became her work. And being a travel writer was really her escape from a lot of personal problems, also personal problems in her dating life. She was engaged and broke that off and also ran away from that when she ran off to Spain.
So how much of this do you know going in? I mean, you have so much of Lily's history just all over the place to work from. Is this something that you know before starting? Did you know all this before you started the book?
I have to admit, I knew so little before I started the book. I will say that knowing that Lily was a travel writer and thinking about her as escaping from things did inform, I guess, a lot of other things in the book, because it made me think about what she was like when she was younger and what her escape would have been at a younger age, for instance. And that's where there's a lot about old movies in the book and these sort of classic movies and sort of movie stars like Ava Gardner that she identifies with. And it was funny because I had watched, you know, quite a few old movies with my grandmother when I was young, but I had to go back and watch a lot of them because Lily had watched so many more than I had. And when she was,
you know, from the time she was about 13 until she was 17 and 18, and moving around with her mother and her sister, these people were almost like surrogate friends to her. She sort of looked at the films in that way. That was really what she had going on instead of a social life, because she didn't really want to tell anyone about her family situation. So there were a few things that I knew, and that led me to think about the character and how she sort of developed this, you know, love of vintage things, this sort of, I mean, she wears vintage clothes, and that sort of, you know, tied into her love of the movies. And also, I guess, made me realize that she's a bit of a secretive character as well. She's not someone who opens up to anyone easily, and so there are only a couple of characters in the book who really know a lot about her background, and she's very good at keeping up this sort of successful facade, and that certainly cracks in the course of the book. But I have to say, when I started, I knew a lot about her relationship with her sister and kind of the pain that she felt about that. And I knew, you know, about her father's death and sort of the troubled history with her mother, but not a lot else, in all honesty. A lot of that came later, and a lot of that came as I redrafted the book. I mean, this is not, I'm not one of those writers who writes really good pages the first time around or the second time around or even the third time around. I'm one of those writers who can write really fast, but I do really messy drafts, and I end up adding a lot of details later in, like drafts 4, drafts 5. They get a lot of the detail work in them.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and our guest is Hilary Davidson, and her new book is The Damage Done. Before you read, and I'd like you to read in a minute, if you will,
sure.
Just off what you said in terms of creating secretive characters. Now, how do you do that when, you know, create a secretive character or a character that might be more internal that readers feel connected to and know well enough to stay with the story? How does that work?
I think that it was important to be upfront early on about certain things that had happened. So when you meet Lily, she is walking up to her sister's apartment, which also used to be her apartment. And actually the scenario in the book is that it really wasn't her sister who's died. It was a woman who'd stolen her sister's identity, but her sister's missing. But Lily, when you meet her at the beginning of the book, thinks her sister is dead. And so she is mentally rehashing a lot of the past, their conflict. So when you meet the character, she's actually in a really vulnerable state, and she lets you in a little bit more at that point because she's very raw and it's sort of like a raw bundle of nerves then. And so later when you see her talking to the police and sometimes lying to the police and things like that, I think that the reader understands better where she's coming from, because no matter what her sister's done, she still feels this incredibly protective sort of urge towards her.
Interesting. Well, have at it. Let's hear you read from,
okay.
Let's hear you from The Damage Done.
That's great. Thank you. So just to set this up, very early on in the book, basically in the first 20 pages or 25 pages, you discover that you know, Lily goes up to her sister's apartment, talks to some neighbors, goes to the morgue to identify the body, and it is not her sister. So at that point, she's confused about what's going on, but very relieved, though the police start coming down on her about what's going on. So this is starting from there. "You just admitted you haven't even talked to your sister in 4 months, the detective snarled at me as he paced. Maybe she changed her hairstyle and you don't recognize her. We've been going in circles since Renfrew had brought me into the 7th Precinct and introduced me to her partner. Detective Bruxton was a pit bull disguised as a man, all lean muscle and sharp teeth and chilly blue eyes that never veered away from their target. That woman in the morgue looks a bit like Claudia, I admitted. She has dark hair and she's about the same height. But Claudia has 6 tattoos, 6 that I know about anyway. This woman doesn't even have one. Claudia has a dragon on the back of her left shoulder, and tattoos can be lasered off." Bruxton popped another piece of nicotine gum into his mouth. "Look, if that woman isn't your sister, who is she?" Detective Renfrew sat across from me, elbows on the table, hands folded together, amber eyes watching me impassively. I wished she would say something, even if it was just to jump in with her own set of accusatory questions. She hadn't said much to me after leaving the morgue. She'd allowed her partner to take charge of the interview, but I felt the weight of her appraising gaze. She was judging every word that came out of my mouth. I told you, I don't know. You've asked me that same question 10 times in the past hour, and I still don't know. I pulled my coat around me tightly. I'd walked by the police precinct at 19 and a half Pitt Street hundreds of times when I'd lived on the Lower East Side. It was literally a block south of my old apartment building on Rivington, and I'd often wondered what it was like inside. Now I knew. It was a freezing block of concrete walls and airless rooms and metal furniture that made me long for the cold winter sun outside. Still, I didn't really give a damn. It wasn't my sister in the morgue, after all, and I couldn't hide my relief. "It's your sister. Admit it," Ruxton said. "No," I shook my head. "It's not Claudia." "I don't like people playing games with us," he said. "There are a lot of things we need to be doing right now. This is an open and shut case." "I am not making this up," I protested. "I know. I haven't been in touch with my sister in months. This is the longest we've ever gone without speaking. I've been trying to call her and email her, and I haven't heard anything back. But I know what she looks like, and that woman in the morgue is not Claudia." "Rux," said Renfrew, "why don't you tell her what you know?" "Cards on the table," said Bruxton. He put both hands on the table and leaned forward so that his face hovered close to mine. I guessed he was in his late 30s, but up close I saw the fault lines etched into his face. The lines made him look older, but the scars made him seem dangerous. "When were you planning to tell us about your mother?" "My mother?" My mouth was dry. "What does she have to do with this?" "We know," he said ominously. "Know what?" I wasn't going to make this easy for him. If he wanted to dredge up the past, he could do it alone. "Your mother killed herself on New Year's Eve 11 years ago. I stared back at him silently while my stomach clenched. For a moment, I felt 18 again, as if I were hearing the news for the first time, feeling it with the force of a slap. Bruxton's voice was as flat and jaded as that of the officer who had told me about my mother. There was something triumphant in his face that made it clear he knew more than he was saying. He expected me to roll over in shock or break down in tears. Instead, my hands clenched into fists under the metal table and my nails sliced into my palms. "What does that have to do with this dead woman I've never met before?"
That was fabulous. That was Hillary Davidson reading from The Damage Done. That was great.
Yeah.
You know, I'm curious. We talk a bit about this on the show when you're writing dark and enmeshing yourself in these worlds of, you know, dark characters, heavy subject matter, and what that does to you as writer. Does it make the world easier for you to take in some ways? Does it bring you down?
You know, on a day-to-day basis, it actually does bring me down sometimes. One of the, I guess the way sort of a friend has described it, and I've adopted this, is that writing this way, certainly writing dark, can be a bit like method acting, where you get so deeply into the head of the character that if they have a fight with someone, you feel like you've had a fight with someone as well. And so I feel a little bit sorry, actually, for my husband, who's had to sort of talk me down after a day of, you know, finding out bad things in the book and writing about them. But it's also something that's easy to let go of after the book reaches a certain state of completion. It's very intense for me when I'm writing a draft of it, and certainly when I was thinking a lot about Lily and also about her family and the people around her. There are other characters in the book, some of her sister's friends who are still involved in drugs, some who seem to have gotten away. And Lily doesn't really know who to trust. And writing it, I didn't necessarily know who to trust either, because I had a vision of how the story opened and a little bit of a vague notion of how it ended. But I was just emotionally wrapped up in it, as Lily was, really, for all intents and purposes, when I was doing the first draft. So I would definitely say that's a challenge. And for me, I haven't found a really good way out of that. I'm working on a new book now, and I've had the same process when I've been writing the first draft, that when something bad happens in the story, it definitely puts me into a darker mood. And I really do have to work to come out of it, but then it also lifts me a bit out of the story as well, and I need then to work harder to get back into it the next day. So it's almost like a choice, like, would you like to be miserable for about 3 months while you write this? Or, you know, would you like to come out of it, but then you really do need to sort of submerge yourself again? Because I think maybe part of this is because I wrote in the first person, but, you know, there was a part of my brain that was submerged with the character, and that was constantly thinking about what was going on and thinking about her world.
How long did the first draft take?
It took 3 months.
Yeah.
When I actually sat down and wrote it, a very messy, horrible first draft that needed to be gone over many, many, many times, just even to make sense. Because when I started, there were characters in the book that just vanished midway through because I realized that I didn't actually need some of the characters that I'd populated the book with, and I actually ended up adding a couple of characters. So my first draft is almost like a stream of consciousness where people appear and disappear, and there's not necessarily much sense to it. So I needed to go back and fix a lot when I went into the second draft.
Was the 3 month a deadline of your own making?
It was, because I had the idea early on that I needed to have a daily minimum word count, just because after years of freelancing, I am a very deadline-driven creature, and I knew that, you know, if it were just sort of up to me and when I could fit time into my schedule and that sort of thing, it would just not get done. It wouldn't get written. So I had a minimum of 1,000 words a day that I had to write for the book. And, you know, over the course of 3 months, it actually gives you a complete manuscript, mm-hmm. even if it is a really messy manuscript.
So once you have the manuscript, then you have your however many words and your novel's finished, then what was the revision process like? Did you have a number of readers at that point, or did you go through it and try to make sense of it and then bring in readers? What happened?
Well, I guess I am in a writer's workshop, and I brought it into the group, but brought it in a little bit too early. Initially, I brought it in while I was still writing the book, and what happened for a while was that I was bringing chapter one in, and I honestly must have easily a dozen times. I think in the acknowledgments I say 18 times because that's what someone else in the group thinks it was. It's entirely possible it was that many times because I kept sort of starting the book in slightly different ways, and I would change my mind about something and go back and fix something in chapter one and bring that back in. So I did bring it into my writer's workshop, but it ended up sort of a lot of focus on the opening of the book and then some select chapters later, and they never actually saw the whole thing, which was strange, but I can only bring a certain number of pages in, you know, each week, so it's a little bit limited, you know, timing-wise. I actually gave, and this is something every writer says never, ever, ever do, but I gave the book to my husband and to my mother to read. And everyone else says, don't ever do that because those people will just tell you how great your book is. But they don't know my husband and my mother because they are amazing critics. And they are really, really good at just saying, this doesn't make sense, this isn't working. My mother even is a pretty amazing copy editor, actually. That hasn't been her line of work, but she's just really good at it. But they are very upfront about telling me all the things in the book that they think are wacky and not working and, you know, what didn't make sense to them. So I actually took feedback from them and went back and rewrote the book. And that I think they maybe saw draft three. I had already done a full second draft before I let anyone see it. And after that, I'd been approached by Nat Sobel, who's a really legendary agent. He and his wife, Judith Weber, run the Sobel Weber Agency. And he'd seen a short story of mine, Anniversary, which originally appeared in Thuglet. And he was wondering if I was working on a book. So when I finally felt that it was ready, I showed it to them and basically thought, you know, this is very exciting. I have an agent who's approached me, and I have this book that's ready to go. And basically, Judith Weber is a very amazing editor. She used to be at I'm not going to remember the company name offhand, but she's an incredibly talented editor. And we had a meeting where she basically told me that there was an entire subplot of the book that tied into at least half of the book that, you know, really needed to come out because it was cluttering up the book. And at the time, I was sort of terrified. I didn't really see how I was going to rewrite this book again and pull out a subplot. And, you know, the subplot made certain things in the book work, so how was it going to work, you know, if it didn't have that? But I have to say, she was absolutely brilliant and completely right. And it took me about 3 weeks to do another draft of the book, basically to what the agency wanted to see. And, you know, it really did improve the book. And I guess with the sort of the amount of focus they gave me, they didn't just say, oh, well, this isn't what we're looking for, you know, go back to the drawing board and do something else. You know, it was very specific in terms of changes that they wanted to see in terms of the plotting. And so then the fortunate thing was that when it was sent out and when Forge bought it, really there was very little editing that happened to it after that. So I was very lucky in that way.
Hmm. We're chatting with Hillary Davidson. The book is The Damage Done. I'm curious if you allow yourself to read in the genre you're writing in while you're writing. If you read mysteries or if you watch, you know, crime dramas, there's no end to them on television.
Oh, I know. I can. This is so embarrassing to admit. I cannot read in the genre while I am working on a book. I can read short stories, and I do that. And I can read nonfiction without any problem. I cannot read in the genre when I'm actually focused on writing a book, and it's actually cut down the amount of reading I do, which is the one thing that makes me sad about what I'm doing. But what I found is that it actually creeps into the voice of the character. It will change things as I'm writing, and I'll go back and think, oh, that doesn't sound like Lily at all. That, you know, does not make sense. And in a couple of cases, it actually affected something she did, and I thought, no, this is just not fitting my character. So I actually had to stop reading other mysteries and thrillers while I was working on the book.
Interesting. We have a minute left, and I wanted to just ask you about your writing short stories. You published quite a few, and do you think that's important in terms of publishing fiction or novel-length fiction, or even writing novel-length fiction?
It has been so valuable to me to write and publish short stories. Part of it, just in terms of working through problems that happen when you're writing, trying different voices, writing in the third person, writing as a male character, doing all of these different things that are much more experimental than I can do in a novel. And it's also really helped in terms of getting people in the mystery community to sort of know who I am and to get familiar with some of my fiction. It definitely got my book a much warmer reception than it would have had when it came out. People have been so supportive. It's just been incredible to me.
Hmm. The mystery community is a good one, huh?
They are. The mystery community is absolutely incredible. I've been bowled over. These people write very dark things during the day, and then they are kind and warm and wonderful, you know, away from that. So
yeah. Well, it's been great talking to you, Hillary, and you're going to be out in California, Southern California, I believe.
I am. I have an event at the Mystery Bookstore in Westwood on Tuesday, October the 19th at 7 p.m. And then 2 days later, on the 21st, I'll be at Mystery Inc. in Huntington Beach at noon that day.
Yeah, so. Debbie Mitch's wonderful new store, a new independent bookstore in Orange County, which is quite interesting.
I'm very, very excited about that. Actually, just about the mystery bookstore in L.A., they've made my book, The Damage Done, their Discovery Club selection for the month. So that was
excellent.
A really lovely thing. I'm very excited about
That's great. Thank you so much, Hillary, for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you so much, Barbara, for interviewing me. This has been such a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. That was Hillary Davidson. If you want to know more, visit thedamagedone.net. Actually, damaged done. No, the damage done. I can't read my own writing. Anyway, thedamagedone.net. And her events are on there, as well as all other kinds of good stuff regarding the mystery genre and her books in particular. We're out of time, Marie.
I know. It goes fast.
It goes fast. And you're here next week alone.
I'm here all by myself. I know.
Oh, it'll be good, though. Do you know who you're having on?
I'm interviewing Sharon Doger, who wrote The Annexed, which is a different perspective on the Anne Frank story. Mm-hmm. It's told from Peter's perspective, mm-hmm. so I'm excited about that. And I'll be with one other guy whose name I forgot.
Is that the Grammar?
Yes. I have
the Glamour of Grammar.
Glamour of Grammar.
Yeah, he should be fun.
I have the attention span of a gnat this morning.
Well, I have the attention span of a goldfish, so we're a good
we're
combo.
A pair. Yeah, we're a
good pair. Anyway, all of you out there, thank you for giving us an hour of your time, and have a wonderful day. Don't forget to write.
See you next week.
See you next week.